5 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It is always a great pleasure when we can talk about the all-surpassingly important topic of education on the morning show. And I'm very excited for the next few minutes as we speak with Dr. Kathleen Corley, the author of a wonderful book called The Magical Place We Call School, Creating a Safe Space for Learning and Happiness in a Challenging World. Chicago-born Kathleen Corley has had a long career in education, and I'm happy to say she began that career as an elementary music teacher and eventually moved into administration and has been a principal at a number of different schools, actually the founding principal at three different schools. And she draws upon her many years of experience and insight in writing this book, in which she shares many different thoughts about all kinds of different facets of public education and what it means to create a school in which students can feel exceptionally safe and motivated and respected and able to learn to their highest potential. And there is a lot to learn from this marvelously written book, and I'm so excited to be able to speak with the author. The book is published by Forefront Books. Again, it's titled The Magical Place We Call School. And Dr. Kathleen Corley, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction. Sounds like my mom wrote it.
We have a couple of things in common, you and I. First of all, we're both products of the Midwest. We're both Chicago Cubs fans. I actually sang the national anthem for a Cubs game back in 2001. And
that's my dream.
And my wife is a retired public education, public school music teacher. And I teach music at our local liberal arts college. So education is a big, big part of my life, as is music. And so I took your book in hand with just special delight and really, really enjoyed it. I should think one of the challenges is not finding things to write or having things to say, but having, in a sense, too much to say. I mean, when we're talking about a career decades in public education, how do you go about the task of kind of making sense of it all and figuring out what are the most important things that I want to say and how I want to say them?
I have to give credit to Glenn Plaskin on that score. The thing that kept me from writing all those years, first it was, well, I don't have anything important to say. Because I was young then, and I didn't know a whole lot. And then later, when people would ask me, I would think, okay, I have all these stories, and they make sense to me, and I use them when I'm training assistant principals or coaching teachers, because they have a purpose. They end up having a purpose. But I don't know how to organize them. And the organization started to develop with a few tips from Glenn. It became pretty much just what I wanted it to be, and I think it makes sense.
It really does. It's beautifully written, and it's packed, and yet not in an overwhelming way. I mean, I really admire the way in which you have told kind of a sprawling and complicated story. I want to talk for a moment about the decision you made back in 1987, when at the time you were a elementary music teacher in Palatine, Illinois. And you made the leap. I mean, In some ways, it's a natural step, but in other ways, it's a leap from the classroom to becoming a assistant principal. You say, mm-hmm. I wanted to increase my sphere of influence beyond a single classroom. Tell us more about that particular hunger and what was sort of behind that.
There was a turning point. Music teachers, as you probably know, might end up teaching in multiple schools at the same time in the same year. So Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I'm at this school, and Tuesday, Thursday, I split between these other two. I was teaching at three schools at one time and then just two schools, which was infinitely better, a third better anyway. There are these three second grade classes at what I would consider my second school, at a home school and then this other school. So at this other school, the second grade teachers always, always walk with their students to the next class. So the first two second grade teachers, who I thought were great, they were older women, they were fabulous people, and they cared very much about their children. And they would walk their children to the classroom like anybody else, and then they would say to me, I need to know if there's a problem with anybody. Yes, I understand. There never was, almost never was. The third one, our introduction to each other was her in the vault looking up all of her students' records and keeping track of how many were single-parent families and how many were from poor families, and then complaining about that. That was my introduction to her. And so when she brought her children to class, not always, but a couple of times, she would stand at the end of the hallway and watch them walk to me. And the first time, now I'm a brand new teacher. I just fell off the turnip truck. So I turned my head, much like one of my dogs does when I'm confusing him, looking at her, making eye contact, like, why are you down there while your children are not behaving as they walk down the hall? And she knew what my look meant. I'm just quizzical. I haven't said anything. I'm not going to call her out on it. She says, I'm making sure they can walk without me. No, you're not. You're just lazy. So I was thinking, okay, when they walk in my room, I play the Pink Panther song. Do-do-do-do. And as soon as that happens, they know they're supposed to be quiet, go right to their seats, and then we're going to make a lot of noise. And then at the end, I'm going to play that song again. They'll sit up straight in their seats, and they'll walk out. And one time, one of the children asked, why do we have to be quiet when that happens? I said, oh, because it's the Pink Panther song. Okay. He doesn't speak. It was the perfect song for the occasion. So I'm thinking, I can control every single thing in this room. I don't necessarily need to, but I can. I don't like the way that second grade teacher does that thing. I wonder if I had a whole building, could I move her off of her notion of just barely phoning it in? Or would I need to work to have her sell Mary Kay or something instead?
Well, it obviously was a move that has proven to be a wonderful move for you. For as fine a music teacher as you were, you have certainly left your mark in a lot of great ways as an administrator, and we'll get into some of that in just a moment, some of the interesting experiences you've had. At one point, you share a term that I've never seen before, administrivia, which you talk about how a principal is someone who, among other things, ends up dealing with a whole lot of things that the typical teacher would not in any way be interested in dealing with. And I wonder if you could just talk for a moment. You don't spend a lot of time in your book talking about so-called administrivia, but surely that is a big part of the life and a big part of your responsibilities. To what extent is that a frustration for you? I mean, to what extent do you wish you could devote yourself wholly and solely to the central matters of public education?
It would be nice to have a clerk or someone do all of those things. But the principal really does need to do them. It's reports. It's keeping up with changes in protocols for things, making sure we meet deadlines on things. We have a very I wouldn't call it intensive, but thorough teacher evaluation program in the state. And it has a lot of, there are a lot of cliques involved. Oh, you'll like this analogy. You know, in Baroque times, musicians were paid by the note that they played in some circumstances. So if I'm writing for you to play, you will slip me something. So I write lots of flourishes and things so that you can make a little bit more money. And the tuba player or the equivalent of it is really not in a good place. He's not going to make as much money as everybody else because it's usually longer notes, right? I believe that whoever wrote this program that has very good content was paid by the click that we're supposed to make to get deeper and deeper and deeper into the program. So just putting the evaluations into the system requires clicking pretty deeply, like 6 to 8 clicks every time you're going to do something. And you need to do it for a staff of 90. So that's administrivia at its height. And I want to see the paycheck of the guy who wrote the program for the State Department of Education, because it takes me back to Baroque times.
We're speaking with Dr. Kathleen Corley, and we're talking about her book, The Magical Place We Call School, Creating a Safe Space for Learning and Happiness in a Challenging World. In this book, Dr. Corley shares all kinds of thoughts on what schools should be and need to be in order for students to have as positive and beneficial an experience as possible. And of course, that means, among other things, trying to address the emotional needs of each and every child, their emotional well-being, which, of course, is essential to any person being able to learn and perform to the height of their ability. You spend a fair amount of time talking about a really remarkable public school up in Salem, Massachusetts, the Saltonstall, but kind of nicknamed the Salts, and you were its founding principal. And there are three times in your career that you have been the founding principal of a given school. This is some of the most interesting stuff in the book. And I think a lot of us don't even stop to think about how every school has had a first or founding principal. And that first or founding principal faces all kinds of extraordinary responsibilities beyond the principals who follow after. Just in a very brief nutshell, I'm afraid, just give our listeners a sense of what we're talking about here, and also why it was really important to you to tell this particular story of your career as thoroughly as you do.
The Saltonstall was a unique opportunity, once in a lifetime, maybe once in a decade at any place for anyone to experience. There was a gigantic grant that Salem got, and they paired with Salem State University and a local business, but a major business, to change schools in a significant way, to do something important that would become a model for others. And I remember attending the meetings later in Washington, D.C., where we were all supposed to report on what we did. Now, I wasn't there for the beginning part. Teachers and parents worked about 18 months and decided what they wanted in a school. So it's a teacher, mainly teacher-driven initiative. When I was reporting, people would stand up and say, "We decided to have chess for every student starting in second grade, and we're really proud of it." And then they go on to say why they're proud of it. And they got less money than we did, but okay. Oh, that's nice. And they were all kind of like that. And it was my turn, and I stood up and said, "We had an old-style building, 1914, with beautiful dental work in the auditorium that was rehabbed for $6 million, and then it became our home, and all of the programs there were initiated by the planning committee. They just hired me because I agreed with everything they said regarding the mission, and then we made it better. Room was pretty quiet because we spent the money very well, and we built a new school, basically. When you're starting from the very beginning and the teachers are in charge, you just can't miss.
Right. And of course, part of what this school was predicated upon was trusting the teachers and what they know. I am so glad you share. I'm so glad you share one intriguing story about the whole matter of what your title would be. And you tell us that, you know, that one of the more uncomfortable moments you had as things were gearing up for Salt and Stahl to open was that there were quite a number of teachers that did not want a principal, or if there was a head administrator, that they not be called a principal. And this had to be a really disconcerting moment. It clearly was from the way you describe it. Tell us a little more about what was going on there and how all that was ultimately resolved.
One of the teachers, her name is Betty Ray. Betty Ray she has a filter, but she doesn't see why it needs to be engaged. I guess that's a good way to put it. So Betty says what she's thinking. And Betty, by the way, when people say they were on the bridge in Selma in 1964, and if everybody who said that really was, the bridge wouldn't be there anymore because it would have collapsed under the weight. Betty was there. So that's who Betty is. She's an activist, is what I'm saying. So Betty said, you know, we were just, it was offhanded. The team is together, is like 12 of us. She says, you know, we didn't really want a principal. I mean, we didn't think we needed a like head of school or anything. And I'm kind of taken aback. And the other people were almost as uncomfortable as I was because they're trying, you know, Betty, take a break. Betty, stop. But no, she's not going to do that. She said, but I mean, now that we have you, we should have a different title for you. We should have something else. And I said, well, we have plenty of time to figure that out. And I just sort of put it on a shelf. And then the next time it came up, I kind of poo-pooed it. And then the next time it came up, I thought, boy, they really want this thing. I said, okay, here's the test. If whatever the title is, headmistress, whatever, if Joe Lunchbox is going to say, isn't that just like a principal? And then I'd have to say, why, yes. Yes, it is. Then he'd say, why don't you call yourself a principal? So it's like I'm being pretentious. And Betty's still not satisfied. Like, no, I think it should be something else. And I said, okay, I insist. If it's going to be anything other than principal, I want Archangel. And I did the pose with my arms. And they must have thought they had a loon for a principal or Archangel or whatever. But we never talked about it again.
By the way,
and I was called a principal.
Right. By the way, as you're telling that story, and I think it's at that moment or right around it in this process, you say at one point, there was silence again. My kind of silence. What do you mean by my kind of silence?
I think they finally got it. I think they started to understand who I am and what they could count on me for. I hear you. I understand. It's like Japanese. Yes. Yes. I hear you. Yes. I hear you. No, I'm not going to do that. I hear you, but this is not the most important thing we have to do. We needed to put together policies. We needed to get on the roster for the state of Commonwealth of Massachusetts. That is, you don't exist as a school until you have a school number, and then they start sending you reports so you can have some administrivia to play with. There was all of that to do, besides the big idea stuff and buying the furniture and outfitting things and encouraging people to come because it's a choice district. You have to market your school.
Right, and that was a big part of your job. And by the way, you share a 10-page single-space position paper which kind of laid out the principles by which this school was going to operate. I mean, that by and large these teachers had put together grouping the students in multi-age clusters, all of the younger students taking Suzuki violin, all students taught a second language as part of the regular curriculum, and on, an absolutely fascinating list. You liken it to Martin Luther's 95 Theses.
hang on there.
It's also at one point, as you're describing all this, which is so interesting, and by the way, we should tell our listeners that the building, which is a beautiful old historic structure, ends up not being ready for business that first fall, and you have to scramble around to find other places for the education to happen. I mean, this whole story in and of itself is so fascinating. I want to ask you about something that's, in a sense, rather trivial, and yet I find it really intriguing. When you're talking about one of the, your key colleagues in the planning stage for the Saltonstall, you call this particular person a formidable thought partner. A formidable thought partner. I just love that concept. I can't remember ever actually hearing that particular turn of phrase before, but I should think anybody who is in education, whether they're a teacher or an administrator, probably benefits greatly from having a formidable thought partner. What does a formidable Absolutely. Thought partner mean to you?
Someone who is not going to accept necessarily what I have to say at face value. I may think I have thought through it quite well, excuse me, and that person should be good at finding what I missed or challenging me on what it is that I have just said. I'm famous, not famous, I say on a regular basis, I see two or three people in the hallway and I say, I need to borrow your brains, which is exactly the same thing. And there's usually a sarcastic comment that goes along with it. Well, there's not much left of mine because it's been a rough week or something like that. Oh, I'm sure there's enough left for what we need to do. I absolutely positively need them, and I also want them to be a part of what I'm thinking of. There are things that are surprises. You know, we do goofy things like pickle tasting for the staff members, and there are 80 jars of pickles out there, and everybody stands outside my office and tries the pickles with crackers, and, well, that one's hot, I need something to drink, and they just have a great time with it, or a caramel apple bar, or a whatever. Those things are surprises. Those things, that's between the assistant principal and me, usually. But for other things, they need to be involved because they'll come back to me after I've asked them about some harebrained idea I have. They'll come back and go, you know, if you just changed the first part and you didn't invite everybody to the second part, I think you'd get what you want. Wouldn't that work? And I'd say, yes. Do you want a piece of this project? Do you want all of this project? And the person might smile and say, I was hoping you would say that because we're raising leaders. They're a bunch of kids here as teachers, not all of them, but many of them are in their 20s. And they're awesome, but they don't lead stuff so much yet. But they'll have the confidence to do that if they lead smaller projects. Mm-hmm. It's not that I'm trying to get everybody to be an administrator. They may do something. They may be an assistant superintendent for curriculum. They may be a superintendent. I don't know. They should do whatever it is they want. But they should have the impetus to do things beyond their classroom walls. Because that's the fun part.
Absolutely. Speaking of fun, I wanted to say that at one point you say, I have always been a believer in the power of fun. And I think some of what we've already talked about, that's pretty clear that you have a good sense of humor and appreciate fun and having fun and the value of fun. But it's really intriguing to me as well that you are a principal who clearly believes that it's not just about fun. It's about a lot of other really serious matters, and that the way you use fun is within, I should say, maybe a certain framework and a certain set of expectations of students and of teachers and of everybody. And I really appreciate that. It seems to me that a really good teacher, a really good administrator, a really good parent, a really good lot of things has to do with how we use fun. And if fun is the only thing versus if fun is just one element in what how we're going about what we're doing.
I think you know me like an analyst. I don't have one. We should talk later, maybe. Yes, you are right. If the classroom is all about fun and we're not getting things done because the class loses it after they've had the fun, like you can't get their attention back, that's the problem. So I'm the great construction cone mover. I protect time for learning. We don't do interruptions to the class day. You won't hear, you'll hear announcements in the morning. Right after you hear, our mantra is respect, and it stands for responsibility, empathy, self-control, being positive, showing effort, cooperation, and being trustworthy. So instead of a bell in the morning, I mean, who needs that? Aretha Franklin sings respect, just a bit of it, and that's you should be in your seat, and we should be ready to go. So after she does that, I do the announcements. And when I do the announcements, the last thing I say is ask good questions, make good decisions, leave things better than the way you found them, especially people's hearts, and please show respect. Well, if you do all those things, you're going to be a sort of button-down, all-about-business kind of place, and you're just waiting, kind of, for the fun to happen. And the fun can happen if classes are under control and children are decent to each other and they respect each other. We're a uniform school. We're a uniform district. But not everybody follows the uniform procedures. Like shirts are supposed to be tucked in, and if there are belt loops on whatever you're wearing on the bottom, you need to have a belt, except for kindergarten and first grade, because what clean up aisle for boys who don't plan well enough ahead to undo the belt. So it's just, you just have to give them a little bit of grace there. So we do it the way it was written, because whatever you put in the handbook, you should be following. And if you don't want it in the handbook anymore, then take it out. Good example of that. It distracted, the things that will distract people. It used to be different color hair, like green or orange or pink or whatever. We had it in our policy, no colored hair that's other than hair color hair. It's not as awkward as I just said it, but you get the idea. Well, it became sort of commonplace out in the natural world out there, so I took it out of the handbook because it's not a distraction now. If it's commonplace, and it's not hurting anybody, and it's not ugly or evil or immoral, then it's okay. I don't like it necessarily because I'm an old person and I don't think people should be dyeing their kids' hair weird colors, but that has nothing to do with it. It is no longer a distraction. So why have it in there? We're not going to just not enforce it because then people say, well, what else are you not enforcing? Well, we're enforcing everything that's in there, but we're progressive and we can learn to walk upright.
Right. I think that blend of, in a sense, law and order and fun is the ticket to great success. Not that it's easy to achieve that balance, but you know, clearly you have managed to do that. One of the abiding themes of your book, and of course central to what you are all about, is caring. Of observing, of knowing your students well and caring about who they are and why they're doing what they're doing. And at one point in the book, there's a list called Corleyisms, which are some of your sort of maybe the principles by which you do what you do. And a couple of them really leapt out at me that I thought were so beautiful. Students don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And also,
right. And that's not original from me. Just so you know, but it's something that I say a lot.
Right, and I so appreciate that. And also, some students come to school to learn. Some come to be loved. Then they learn. And of course, it's so poignant to think about somebody who maybe comes from a difficult place, where school can be and needs to be the place where they experience love and security and safety. I mean, more so than in any other facet of their lives.
Yes, this should be the most beautiful, lovely, comforting place that they can possibly imagine outside of their home. And in some cases, it definitely replaces their home when it comes to the safety part, because there are things they will tell us that they will not tell a parent, or they've told a parent and nothing happened to rectify the situation. So then we gently talk to the parent about what the problem is and go from there.
A last quick question. You describe towards the very beginning of the book kind of the opening of the typical school day, and especially the first day of school where you are a principal now. And one of the things you describe there, I think you call it call to the post at 7:15 a.m. Explain to our listeners what you are doing at 7:15 a.m.
At about 7 o'clock, the cars start to line up, the ones who really have to get out of here and get to work. And call to the post is the first bell. That's the one that goes da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And that's trumpet recorded on the intercom. That's the, okay, open your car doors because we are now on duty. You can't drop your kids off when we can't supervise them, although people try to do it on the regular. Have to call them and go, hey, no, we can't do this. We can't pay people before 7:15. It's just not going to work. So they start coming into the building, and they go to a variety of places. They may go outside to play. They may be going to a club that happens. My club happens on Tuesdays and Thursdays in the morning, and it's a drum and dance team. The dance teacher takes care of the dancers, and I take care of the drummers. And so we play drums for the first 20 minutes or 30 minutes before school starts. Then they get breakfast if they've gone to a club, and then it's off to the classroom. And if somebody's late, the social worker goes outside to say, hey, why are you late? Because they have to sign the card to say why they're late. And after a while, when she gets tired of talking to the same people, then I go outside and say, how can we help you get to school on time? Well, I don't understand why you make such a big deal out of it. Because it's, you know, it's just my kid. Actually, it's not, as a matter of fact. It is the entire class, because the teacher's finally rolling and she's got everybody's attention. And then Thomas walks in and every head turns to Thomas. And they might even say hello to him, which is a good thing. But Thomas is going, yeah, I'm late again, in his head, because I don't think he enjoys it. But you've just interrupted the teacher and about, 18 to 20 students. How can that be cool? How can that be okay? Help me with this. Help me help you change this problem.
Well, working together, of course, is a hallmark of all that you have done through your long career. And your mentor named Al, who worked with you as you first became an administrator, one of his guiding axioms is be firm but not rigid. And it seems to me that you have lived that out in all kinds of exciting ways in your career as both a teacher and an administrator, and now sharing so many insights in your wonderful new book, The Magical Place We Call School, Creating a Safe Space for Learning and Happiness in a Challenging World, published by Forefront Books. One of the best books about education I think I have ever read. The author, Dr. Wow. Kathleen Corley. Dr. Corley, thank you so much for being my morning show guest, and thank you for all the good that you are doing in the world on behalf of students and teachers alike. And thanks again for this conversation.
Thank you. I enjoyed it thoroughly. Oh, and by the way, my ringtone is Law and Order theme.
Very good. Thanks again.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we're going back 20 years in the Morning Show archives to a conversation recorded back in 2004 with someone who, at that point in time, was one of the most famous teachers in America. Certainly one of the best known and most admired teachers in the entire country has to be Ron Clark. He was designated the 2001 Disney Teacher of the Year and has been a very visible presence ever since, a superbly gifted teacher who has a couple of books to his credit, one of them called The Essential 55, which outlines a number of different rules which he likes to follow in the classroom, the 55 important rules for his students to think about in order for them to have the most meaningful experience possible. And now he has written a great book called The Excellent 11, Qualities Teachers and Parents Use to Motivate, Inspire, and Educate Children. It's published by Hyperion. And Ron Clark joins us for a few minutes to talk about his life as a teacher and the experience of writing this book. Ron Clark, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I should think that it is no small matter to sit down and try to write a book about something which is, first of all, so important to you and something which is a very complicated sort of thing to unravel. How much did you learn about teaching and why you teach the way you do and how you teach the way you do? How much of that sort of came to you, did you come to understand, just in the process of trying to write about it in these two books?
You know, writing is an amazing thing. You know, getting your thoughts on paper and actually seeing it, you know, there in print, you know, it's totally different than just living it or just thinking your ideas. And it was very therapeutic for me. It allowed me to go through all of my ideas and kind of get things into a structure. And it was really nice to see how everything came together. But it was wonderful. And it was also nice that after I wrote The Essential 55, I traveled across the country. I went to 49 states talking to teachers and parents about what's really working in education in America. And I had so many great ideas and so many wonderful things I saw that these people were doing. And I just kept taking notes about things I saw that really worked. And it was nice to actually take the time and to put all of those ideas and all those creative strategies I saw into a book, and that's what the Excellent 11 became.
Mm. I want to ask you about a couple of those 11 essentials. The very first one, which is so evident to, for anyone who sees you or meets you, is enthusiasm. But one of the things you say is that enthusiasm is best when it serves a purpose, that just unbridled enthusiasm is not enough really to carry the day or to get the job done.
Right, exactly. I see some first-year teachers just spinning their wheels. They're so excited, and they're trying to motivate these kids, and they're doing these games and different things. And the kids are excited, but they're not really learning. And so I really try in my classroom to pull in education and really to make the core of what we're doing deal with the standard course of study and what these kids are required to know on their intergrade tests. You know, I'm really always standard-driven, making sure that, yes, there's a lot of enthusiasm, I'm excited, sometimes I'll jump on my desk, whatever it takes to get these kids motivated, but I make sure that we're always focused on the curriculum and that there is a purpose in what these kids are learning. And I just beg my parents, I say, please, you know, when you're dealing with your kids, please have a positive outlook about education. You need to be enthusiastic as well about learning, because kids are so impressionable, whether they're 5 years old or whether they're 18 years old, and they look to their parents. And if their parents are enthusiastic about learning and enthusiastic about school and looking forward to the school year, then the kids will be as well.
You also, in kind of taking things full circle, when you get to your 11th essential, which is resilience, you hearken back to the whole issue of enthusiasm, and you remind us that over-enthusiasm is one of the things which can lead to burnout, which, of course, is an increasingly common phenomenon among teachers.
Right, and especially, you know, first-year teachers, I see these teachers enter school systems, and it's typical. It happens in every school where you go. The first-year teachers come in, and they're put on every committee. They're asked to be the coaches. They're asked to serve lunch duty. They're asked to do bus duty, and these teachers say yes. They're first-year teachers. They're excited. They have so much energy and enthusiasm. They want to do all of it. Then after 3 or 4 years, they burn out, and they leave the profession, and we're seeing that happen in schools all across America, that after 3 or 4 years, these exceptional teachers are leaving because they burn out. And so it's important that we have a balance in education. I tell teachers, you know, in order to teach about life, you have to have a life. You have to be willing to take some time for yourself. And I remember sometimes I would have a ton of papers to grade. My friends would say, let's go play tennis. And I'd say, you know what, I'm going to go play tennis. And I'd go play tennis, and the next morning I'd wake up and I'd be rejuvenated, and I'd go in that classroom and I'd say, you know what, kids, I looked through these, I didn't grade them, let's go over them together. I mean, you don't have to feel like you have to grade everything. You don't have to feel like you have to be on every committee to coach everything, and it's okay to say no to the principal sometimes. And, you know, sometimes we just need to close our classroom doors, look at those kids, and focus on them. That's where we're going to get rejuvenated, not trying to serve on every committee or do all the bus duties or do everything that the principal asks. Sometimes it's necessary to say no, because if you don't, you're going to burn out.
Hmm. You're touching on something which is, I think, essential number four, which is reflection. You say one of the best qualities of an exceptional teacher is that he or she learns something from every lesson that is taught, and it takes a moment of reflection, of course, to be able to really achieve that. I suppose for many teachers, it's likely that they get into a cycle, a frantic kind of cycle, which doesn't leave a lot of time for reflection unless you really make a point of including it in your life.
Right, and it all leads back to organization. I keep this binder. Every lesson I do, I devote one sheet of paper in the binder to that lesson, one sheet of paper for every day during that school year, and then after I'm teaching my lessons, after I'm doing different things, I go over and I make notes. I jot down notes of things that worked, things that didn't work, and it helps me. Lots of teachers do this. They keep worksheets that work, they keep information, they keep all different types of little notes for themselves, and so the next year they can go through that binder, remind themselves, they can reflect on what worked, and it'll make them be a better teacher. And everyone knows, you know, if you teach high school history and you teach five periods a day, that fifth period, those kids are lucky. Mm-hmm. They're going to get the best lesson. You know, the first period you're learning about that lesson, the second period you're getting into it, by the fifth period, you know, you've really learned how to master that lesson, you're doing it the best, you know. And if we just will take the time to reflect on what we've done, you know, we'll become better teachers. And also, reflection is important for kids. I love how I see first grade teachers. They'll give little kids on the first day of school, they'll say, all right, first graders, I want you to write one sentence on this sheet of paper. And some of them can, some of them can't, some of them really struggle. Then they'll take up those pieces of paper. Then on the last day of school, they'll give out another sheet of paper. They'll say, now you write a sentence. And then they'll write this beautiful sentence, all of them. Then she'll staple the pieces of paper together and pass them out, and she'll say, look how much you learned this year. I mean, it's wonderful for teachers to reflect and parents to reflect, but also for kids to reflect and say, oh, look how much I learned. You know, that will instill pride in these kids and make them feel good about themselves and encourage them to want to learn more in the future.
Hmm. I love the story you told about your own sixth grade teacher, Mrs. Walker, who had every student in the classroom keep a daily diary of what occurred there. And those diaries stayed in the room until the last day of school, when you were allowed to take them home. And you said you walked out of there feeling like you were holding $1 million. That was such a powerful tool of learning for you.
Yeah. During sixth grade, Miss Walker, she almost drove me crazy, because every day, you know, no matter what happened, we were going to write in that journal for 5 minutes that day. And some days I didn't want to write in it. I didn't think I had anything to write. But she always encouraged us to write about our emotions, our feelings, what was going on. And on that last day when she gave it to us, you know, all those ideas were in there, and I just cherished it so much at that moment, but I had no idea. Now it's one of my most prized possessions in the world, because I don't remember much from my fourth or fifth grade year. I remember some things from seventh grade, but my sixth grade year, it's just vividly clear. I can remember where I sat, my friends, the lessons that we taught, how we changed classes. I can remember racing Hallett Moore and almost beating him in the sixth grade race. I mean, all these things I can remember because she took the time to say, we're going to reflect on this year, and you're going to learn about what life is like in the eyes of an 11-year-old. Mm. And now I can look back and see how I felt at that age, and it's just a wonderful thing.
In the chapter devoted to adventure, trying to foster a sense of adventure in the classroom, I think you really do teachers a great service by talking about realistic adventure. That I suppose, particularly in this day and age, one really has to temper what might be the limits of your imagination on what sorts of adventures to take your classroom on, be it vicarious adventures or whatever, but that one has to have this sense of what is realistic, what is workable, what is going to ultimately achieve something meaningful for these young people.
Right. The first step with adventure is that I always tell my kids, you know, don't sit on your dreams. If there's something that you want to do, go for it. I want them to have courage. I want them to have determination to do these things, and I try and set an example for them. And also with adventure in the classroom, I try to do things to spice up that year. You know, especially if you're dealing with junior high students, you know, you can't just present the information to them. They're not going to get it. They need it to be exciting. They need it to be spiced up. They need something to really catch their attention and to be different. And doing adventure and pulling in, whether it's a scavenger hunt or something unusual or something where if you can manage to take them on a field trip where they're learning on that field trip, whatever you're doing, it's important to make things a little bit spicy, to make things a little different, and to add adventure into that classroom. And to my parents and my students, I say, listen, if you're dealing with a 13-year-old kid, and if you're having troubles with that kid, and you can't, if you don't have a good relationship or you can't relate to each other, then the best way to pull yourself together is to do something dealing with an adventure. When we're challenged at the same time, it bonds us. Like, for example, if you could take your 13-year-old to a local rock climbing wall, I know some parents are like, there ain't no way in the world I'm going up a rock climbing wall, but if you can do it, if you could push yourself a little bit, challenge yourself and challenge your 13-year-old and do it together, when you're done, you're going to feel like, yes, we did it. It's going to bond you together. Go to a local amusement park and ride a roller coaster together. Go camping. I know some of these things might be difficult and they take some time, but if you can do them, you're really going to do a lot to foster a good relationship with your 13-year-old or your child, no matter what age they are.
I was a bit surprised when you said the number one thing parents and teachers can do to positively affect the lives of our children and students is to become more aware of the way we speak to them.
That's it. Words are so powerful. And I see so many teachers and parents telling kids, you know, you're always talking, you're so disrespectful, you're so rude, your room's always a mess, you're doing this, you're the worst class I've seen. And kids are impressionable. They look to us to see who they are. They see themselves in our eyes. Whether they're 18-year-olds or 5-year-olds, they respect us whether or not we believe it, and they look to us to see who they are. And when we look at them, we've got to make sure we're speaking to them in a manner that points out their positive qualities, the things that they're doing well, and shows them their potential. Words are powerful.
In our last minute, I want to find out from you this great adventure which you have been on since been giving this great award. Has it been something of a disruption in your own teaching career? I mean, are you able still to be in the classroom as a teacher, or if not at the moment, do you look forward to the day when life will calm down and you can do what you've always done?
Right. I'm not a conventional teacher right now. I am still teaching, but I'm not in the classroom. I'm traveling with kids all around the world, going to Japan, taking kids from Harlem. We just got back from South Africa. And so we're traveling all around the world. I'm taking kids from disadvantaged areas and doing these things and teaching them through that way. And I'm traveling across the country, talking to teachers and parents. And so I'm not a regular classroom teacher right now, and I won't be until next year, next fall. But I'm just really enjoying this time, but I miss the classroom. That's my passion. That's where my heart is. And so I'm really looking forward to getting back in there. But we started something really neat. It's this website called www.ronclark.info, I-N-F-O. And it's a place where teachers can go, or parents, and you can type in questions. And all these different teachers and parents across America will give you advice and tips, and you can ask me questions, and it's been wonderful. So that's taken up so much of my time, and the traveling and promoting the books and things like that. It's just been really busy, but I'm looking forward to getting back into the classroom next fall. I can't wait.
And I'm sure the classroom is eager to have you back. The book, again, is The Excellent 11. It's author Ron Clark. Ron Clark, I thank you for joining us and for all of your good work which you have done on behalf of teachers everywhere.
No, thank you so much.
And Ron Clark is still busy educating young people. A few years ago, he co-founded a nonprofit school in Atlanta, Georgia, called the Ron Clark Academy. And in an interesting departure from the norm, back in 2019, Ron Clark competed on the television show Survivor: Edge of Extinction. The time is 8:58, and tomorrow on the morning show, it will be Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the program. With her will be Dave Giordano from Root Pike Wind, the Watershed Initiative Network, talking about an exciting new project as they continue to work to safeguard the watershed here in southeastern Wisconsin. And on Friday, a look at Holy Rosary's Sports Night event, and also a look at the Super Bowl. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Today is going to be cloudy and very mild. We're headed for a high of 49 degrees with some clouds rolling in overnight with a low of 43. Tomorrow will be cloudy with a 40% chance of light rain, and we're going to be warming up to 56 degrees. It will be quite windy tomorrow, gusts up to 35 miles per hour. Sunshine on Friday and a high of 53, and not quite so warm as we get into the weekend. Temperatures back into the upper 30s to low 40s. Still very mild for this time of year. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn in Lake Geneva, NPR.